oil, and gas resources. Invisible hands had created the ground for the recognition of this new state by some neighboring countries. Though news from the fighting in Syria was not that satisfactory, the resistance front started its operations in Iraq. The PMU's important and frequent operations changed the game. The retaking of Jerf al-Sakhar, Beji, and Salah-ud-Din triggered the domino-style defeats of Daesh. When the PMU fighters entered Tikrit, everybody rushed to Fallujah. The city was the head of a serpent called Daesh, and having or losing it could change the course of the war.
After the liberation of Samarra and Amerli that were besieged for 70 days, we retook Jerf al-Sakhar as well. Then we came to cleanse the main headquarters of Daesh terrorists. Daesh wants to eliminate first Shias and then those Sunnis who do not support them. Then Christians, then Yazidis, etc. See the role of the US? The tensions are over now. You saw their main forces gather together to wage war against us as Daesh. Who do you think did this? Was that the idea of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi or the CIA?
Mr. Mohandes, many thanks for joining us. First of all, we're going to start from the obvious question. Why Fallujah? Why now?
We saw that different international networks come to interview you, from French Le Monde to others. We saw that most of the foreign media asked questions about Iran and Haj Qasem, Soleimani's role in Iraq's development. Why do you think the media have focused on the role of Iran and Haj Qasem in particular?
This shows the success of Iran and Haj Qasem. The U.S. had some 200,000 soldiers in Iraq. They spent a lot of money and waged a huge war against Iraq, but received nothing. It's true that the U.S. has a role in Iraq, but not as much as Iran has inside Iraq. They're jealous of Iran's success and Iraq's victories. As you know, the U.S. has a theory and a plan to alienate Iraq from Iran. You saw that a few days ago. The Saudi foreign minister spoke against Iran's presence in Iraq.
Unbiased observers assess these victories, achieved with only 4,000 fallen soldiers, as a great accomplishment. But with Abu Mahdi as the commander, even one martyr is many.
The difference between Iran and the U.S. is that Iran is honest and is working with honesty. Iran really wants to eliminate Daesh, but the U.S. is not. It wants to manage the crisis. We are in close partnership with Iran. The Islamic Republic of Iran is helping the poor around the world, Sunnis, Shias, and minorities. We are proud of this. Why should we get annoyed?
Has it ever occurred to you to think enough is enough, that you should go enjoy your time?
No, I've never ever thought of it.
Why?
I'm okay with that. I've only traveled to war zones inside or outside Iraq. I hadn't seen Tikrit in my lifetime, but war made me go there, and I went there easily. I hadn't seen Fallujah. I've just discovered it. It's a very good area.
Thank you.
Have you felt tired?
Of what?
Of war, of fighting.
No, like anybody who works and gets tired, I would be okay after a short rest.
You don't even rest. You work even at lunchtime.
Now I have to be like that. But it's not routine.
We interviewed Abu Mahdi till dawn. He never decides to sleep. Rather, he falls asleep with exhaustion. Now I understand what a martyr's widow once told me. Upon hearing news of her husband's martyrdom, she said now he can sleep as much as he wants.
Who do you love the most from among the Iranians?
The leader is not for the Iranians only.
Besides him?
Haj Qasem.
Why?
I don't know why. There are lots of reasons.
How is your relationship with him?
Like the relation of a soldier with his commander.
A soldier and Haj Qasem?
Yes, a soldier and Haj Qasem. It's an honor.
The commander of Iraq's PMU is proud of being Haj Qasem's soldier.
Yes, yes, his soldier. It's an honor and a gift from God.
Are you fighting for Iran or for Iraq?
I'm fighting for Iraq, for Iran, and for Islam. No problem. Iran is a sacred land. I'm not afraid. Our fighters were killed in Hovayzeh, in Operation Mersad, in Kermanshah. What for? I believe God gives life and He takes it away too. Not Daesh, not bullets, not anything else can bring us death. There's no fear. We all will die. There's a time stated for our death, and we die on that date. If we're martyred, that will be excellent.
It needs a huge amount of money to accommodate and feed the displaced. Artilleries have easily targeted civilians and then covered it up by saying it was a technical error. The U.S. has done it over and over in Iraq. But this is what differentiates Abu Mahdi from American generals. He visits camps in which people with familial links to Daesh have been accommodated.
Some of the families and children I saw today are Daesh relatives, but we should treat them humanely. We shouldn't tease a person because his or her father is a Daesh member. It's not religious, it's not humane. So one of my priorities in the PMU is to bring back the displaced families to their hometowns. This is our religious duty, and we shouldn't underestimate it.
Has it ever occurred to you to feel afraid of something?
Yes, I fear reporters. You.
Apart from us.
My wife.
How many children do you have? You didn't say that.
Should I say everything? I have four daughters. One of them has a PhD in international relations. Another has an MA in architecture. The other has an MA in chemistry, and the last one is still studying.
Abu Mahdi has been fighting for years, overtly and covertly. This is enough to portray a middle-aged guerrilla, who is these days the pioneer in the fight against Takfiris. But Abu Mahdi is a real teacher. If there was no war, he would definitely be teaching at university, reviewing the formulas of development with his students, but duty is calling on him to take on a different job. Months of precise planning in the war room came to fruition, despite acts of sabotage by the U.S. Battalions from the resistance front managed to liberate Fallujah with the least casualties, thanks to the participation of all Shia and Sunni tribes. Fallujah was a nightmare for the Americans years ago.
Have you written any memoir?
I have some notes, but I haven't put them down as a memoir.
If you plan to write your memoir, what will you name the book?
Abu Mahdi.
Shall we name it the film Abu Mahdi as well?
Yes, I think.
Where would you like to be laid to rest if you got martyred?
I haven't talked about this with anyone except for one person, and I have asked him to contact my family in case I die or get martyred, and ask them about their favorite burial site. I prefer the cemetery of the martyrs because I like to be close to martyrs, and I believe it's a great opportunity for those who are buried near martyrs Muhammad Ali Rajai and Ayatollah Beheshti, two prominent Iranian politicians killed in terror attacks.
What will you do after the demise of Daesh?
I keep on fighting. It should go on till the end of my life. Jihad is a door God has opened only to its special servants. This is what Imam Ali says. It's a golden opportunity. I hope jihad would stay and I would remain to do it.
What would you like to say to the Iranians?
It was a blessing for them that they had Imam Khomeini. They're very lucky to have a leader like Ayatollah Khamenei. Hope God would give him longevity until Imam Mahdi comes back. An old iron bridge that Daesh exploded. We were engaged in fierce fighting with Daesh operatives. We put up a fierce resistance. Then we changed our plan. Instead of going from south to north, that is, instead of going from the Konkeri bridge inside which we were stationed, we started to encircle the terrorists. We moved forward from east to west toward this bridge. Then we took control of Azraghiya. Thank God the area was completely liberated after we took this bridge and the next one. Daesh terrorists fled from Fallujah by swimming.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. The limelight.
The United States simply should not be selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, especially given their role in exacerbating the suffering in Yemen. Experts on the adverse effects of the military-industrial complex recently blasted a plan by the Trump administration to sell nearly $500 million worth of advanced U.S. bombs to Saudi Arabia, which for over 5 years has been leading an airstrike campaign and a starvation blockade that have added tens of thousands of civilian deaths to already staggering toll in Yemen's ongoing civil war. The United Nations, which has called the situation in Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis, in September recommended that the International Criminal Court investigate possible war crimes committed by Saudi and UAE regimes, which has claimed over 100,000 lives. Dear listeners, these were the words of Brett Wilkins' writer. This article is published under the heading, "Experts Blast Trump Plan to Sell Millions in Bombs to Criminal Saudi Regime." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Experts on the adverse effects of the military-industrial complex recently blasted a plan by the Trump administration to sell nearly $500 million worth of advanced U.S. bombs to Saudi Arabia, which for over 5 years has been leading an airstrike campaign and starvation blockade that have added tens of thousands of civilian deaths to the already staggering toll in Yemen's ongoing war. Bloomberg reports the U.S. State Department has notified Congress of its intention to license the sale of some 7,500 Raytheon Pei-Wei precision-guided air-to-ground munitions valued at $478 million to the kingdom, despite its status as one of the world's worst human rights violators and prolific perpetrator of U.S.-backed war crimes in Yemen. If the license is approved, Raytheon will have a green light to sell the arms directly to the Saudi regime. Human rights advocates condemned the proposed sale, citing conduct by Saudi and allied military forces in Yemen. "This deal should not be allowed to stand," asserted William D. Hartung, director of the Arms and Security Program at the Center for International Policy, in a statement recently. "The United States should not be selling precision-guided bombs to Saudi Arabia at this time, given their leading role in the air war in Yemen, which has killed thousands of civilians and prolonged a conflict that is now the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe." Hartung continued, "Saudi access to tens of thousands of precision-guided munitions thus far has not diminished the civilian toll in Yemen. So Pentagon claims that more accurate bombs will reduce civilian casualties don't hold up to scrutiny. A sale could also be seen as a reward to the Saudi regime at a time when it has yet to take responsibility for the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, or reduced its campaign of internal repression against regime critics and human rights defenders. Last but not the least, this should be a decision for a new administration, not a lame duck president. Jeff Abramson, a senior fellow at the Arms Control Association, accused the Trump administration of dangerously pushing more weapons into the West Asia region to countries that have a record of misusing them. The United States simply should not be selling weapons to Saudi Arabia regime, especially given the role in exacerbating the suffering in Yemen, stressed Abramson. The Biden administration has indicated a desire to rethink the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia. The outgoing president should not use his lame duck period to make that more difficult. However, as Washington Post military and national security reporter Missy Ryan noted recently, former four-star general Lloyd Austin, who is Joe Biden's nominee for defense secretary, is currently a member of the Raytheon's board of directors. The United Nations, which has called the situation in Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis, in September recommended that the International Criminal Court investigate possible war crimes committed by Saudi and UAE regimes, which has claimed over 100,000 lives. The UN cited U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition airstrikes that have killed thousands of civilians, the Saudi-led blockade that has exacerbated famine conditions and disease that have killed at least tens of thousands of people in Yemen.
Aperture.
At the height of the Cold War, the CIA launches a highly classified top secret research program into the covert use of biological and chemical agents. In simulated attacks on enemy populations, entire cities throughout America are contaminated with bacteria, exposing millions of Americans to germ warfare. But the real focus of the research is on mastering the art of mind control. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. LSD had become one of the CIA's key interests for its brain warfare program. As the agency theorized, it could be useful in interrogations. Mind control experiments, generally centered around behavior modification via electroshock therapy, hypnosis, polygraphs, radiation, and a variety of drugs, toxins, and chemicals. Now, these experiments relied on a range of test subjects, some who freely volunteered, some who volunteered under coercion, and some who had absolutely no idea that they're involved in a sweeping defense research program. And what was the extent of these brainwashing experiments? How did the CIA use unconsenting people as guinea pigs in thousands of different experiments? Join us on Aperture for your answers on CIA covert experiments.
August 16th, 1951. Madness spreads through the village of Pont-Saint-Esprit in the Gard region in France. Dozens of villagers have been victim of these bouts of madness. The press describes men terrorized by snakes swirling in their stomachs. A doctor recounts the evening of the 25th of August, where dozens of locals were seized by convulsions, like in a night of the apocalypse. Reports from the victims are terrifying. In Pont-Saint-Esprit, they call it the cursed bread drama, because all of those who fell ill ate the bread from the Brion bakery. It's the first time in France that a whole village has gone mad. It made headlines in the press, who wondered what could have caused this collective hallucination. In Pont-Saint-Esprit, the locals panic, and nobody will touch the bread. The hearses quickly arrive in the village. In total, 7 deaths, 300 people poisoned, and around 50 admitted to psychiatric wards. First dead were buried. The investigators initially thought it was a return of St. Anthony's fire, a disease that killed many thousands in the Middle Ages, caused by a parasitic ergo fungus that attacks cereals. The baker was accused of poisoning, then the miller. Arrested and incarcerated, they were released after several months. They say that their confessions were made under duress, and above all, the evidence proved their innocence. It was then thought to be water poisoning, mercury, fertilizers, or a nearby gas factory. But the evidence disapproved these theories one by one. Since then, in Pont-Saint-Esprit, more far-fetched theories have surfaced. Nothing is clear. And for decades, the incident goes unexplained. But against all expectations, 60 years later, a new theory is proposed. Not from France, but from the United States. An American researcher in the Secret Services, Hank Alberelli, is investigating the suspicious death of a biochemist from the CIA, Frank Olson. A specialist in chemical weapons, he carried out experiments on hard drugs like LSD. He was also in France a few months before the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident. Afterwards, he kept sinking into depression, telling his wife that he'd made a terrible mistake. Hank Alberelli then made the link with the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident. Could it have been the CIA and the American Army spraying LSD onto the bread?
I have no doubt at all that Pont-Saint-Esprit was a U.S. Army covert experiment. Initially, I had doubts, and I think initially my doubts were motivated by wishful thinking on my part, where I didn't want it to be an experiment. It was hard to fathom the government doing that. Although at the same time, there were a number of research tracks that were being conducted for the book at the same time. So my being naive about what the government and the U.S. Army was capable of doing was the threshold for that was dwindling.
Is it possible that the Americans drugged an entire village in an ally country, causing, no doubt accidentally, the death of 7 people? Improbable. However, to understand what happened in Pont-Saint-Esprit, we need to look back at the end of the Second World War, when the level of atrocities committed by the Nazis was discovered in the camps, notably horrific experiments carried out on thousands of prisoners by chemists or doctors. Men lacerated, poisoned, burnt alive, exposed to radiation. The Allies hunted the war criminals from Hitler's regime. In 1946 in Nuremberg, the doctors are put on trial. 22 men and one woman who experimented on human beings, who they transformed into lab rats, stand accused. The trial sets a precedent. 7 of the accused are sentenced to death, 11 given prison sentences, and 5 are acquitted. As a result, the Americans draft the Nuremberg Code, a model which gives strict rules for experimenting on humans, notably the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. The experiment must be designed to avoid all unnecessary suffering, physical and mental harm. With the Nuremberg trial barely over, the winners remain cynical. The American Secret Service begins Operation Paperclip. Nearly 1,500 German scientists, including war criminals, are expatriated to America. They are offered a new life in exchange for their knowledge and cooperation.
It was a very serious game of propaganda that we were playing. It was almost a show trial. We're putting the Nazis on trial, but in fact, behind the curtain, we're doing some very nasty things ourselves to basically incarcerated people, poor people, individuals who at the time were called feeble-minded and locked up in institutions. And if you were in one of those institutions, whether you were indigent or an unwed mother or had some sort of mental incapacity, there's a good chance that you may have been incorporated in some sort of medical study, possibly for the government or not, where you would have been used and abused.
Assisted by the German scientists, the Americans begin pursuing their goal of the ultimate weapon, and everything is allowed in the name of the Cold War. On the one side was the Army, whose priority is to win the nuclear arms race. At the time, to test the effects of radiation on a large scale, they used their own soldiers, who were docile and disciplined. Between 1946 and 1962, between 250,000 and 500,000 men were exposed to radiation on Bikini Atoll or in the Nevada desert. They were exposed with no protection, unaware of the risks involved, and afterwards the radiated particles were cleaned up with brooms.
How about radiation? You think there's much danger from radiation?
Well, radiation is the least of the worries that I'm thinking about.
I think most people thought that radiation was the greatest danger, didn't they? Where did they learn different?
Well, prior to our instructions here, we received a very thorough briefing before we even came in this close to contact with it.
On the other side was the CIA, who was above all interested in psychological manipulation. Their goal was to create an infallible truth serum, wipe memories, turn humans into robots, and program them to kill. Conveniently, in 1948, a researcher in the Sandoz laboratories, Albert Hoffman, discovers a molecule that ignites the Secret Service, lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. It's derived from the same rye fungus, long held responsible for the incident at Pont-Saint-Esprit. It was believed that the hallucinogenic properties of this drug were key to psychological manipulation. Fearing that the Russians would get their hands on Sandoz's samples, the Americans bought all of their stock. The discovery of LSD was a godsend for the Army, who on the brink of nuclear weapons were looking for a weapon that could defeat an enemy without firing any weapons. The man who was head of this program longest was James Ketchum, shown here in uniform. He was a psychiatrist who was working for the military. As a patriot, he was prepared to push the boundaries in his research. He tested around 30 drugs, but especially LSD and the dangerous benzylate. He treated 7,000 soldiers, hundreds of whom later sued the army because of the side effects that they still experience and attribute to these drugs. However, when questioned, James Ketchum sees things differently.
I think they were very patriotic. They've not been given credit. They've been called innocent guinea pigs, which they certainly were not. They knew what they were doing, and we told them as much as we could about it. We had to limit the names of the drugs because some of them were artificially made. And if we were to give out the name, of course, that would also reveal the structure, and that we were afraid the Russians would get that. They were apparently following our work. We thought they were ahead of us, but actually they weren't. And so they were watching what we did to see what they could learn and use, and they developed a similar drug later themselves.
In parallel with the Army, the CIA was also developing its own programs, codenamed Bluebird, Artichoke, and later MKUltra. But to carry out these programs on a large scale, they needed funds. In 1950, the Korean War gave them the ideal pretext. Some American soldiers were captured. Detention, pilots admitted having dropped chemical weapons onto Korea, which was forbidden. The Americans claimed this was due to psychological manipulation, and the CIA took advantage of this godsend to obtain budgets that allowed them to work on brainwashing.
During the Korean War, the American pilots who were captured started making apparently false confessions of germ warfare. The first question is, was it really false confessions? But then when they were brought back to the United States, the military and the military psychiatrists studied them and decided that there's mind control operations being run against Americans. So for defensive purposes, we had to study this, figure it out, therefore we created MKUltra. Before MKUltra was Bluebird and Artichoke. So the whole rationale is it's defensive. It's because of what the communists are doing. Problem is, the Korean War started in June 1950, and Bluebird was signed into operation by the head of the CIA in April 1950.
In the Edgewood camp where James Ketchum worked, soldiers are called upon more and more. They think they're testing gas masks. In reality, the canisters are filled with a toxic chemical.
They were testing a whole assortment of different hallucinogens like LSD and marijuana and things like that. And they explored other drugs, very high levels of atropine, scopolamine, benzylates, very powerful. And a lot of these soldiers ended up incapacitated. It took them a long time to recover. And while they're in recovery, the doctors cannot do any more experiments because it's basically a very small base and testing operation. In other words, they needed a new site.
It's in this context of the Cold War and secret agents that on the 16th of August, 1951, the tragedy at Pont-Saint-Esprit unfolded. France was suffering economically, and the Americans distrusted this ally they couldn't control. The village was under the control of socialists at the time. In the eyes of America, they were Reds, the epitome of the Soviet danger. But the mayor, Roger Castillon, doesn't believe in a foreign conspiracy. Yet American experts like Colin Ross are much more down to earth.
Obviously, that compound didn't just come in the rain. or just wasn't sitting around naturally. It was obviously organized, controlled, distributed. So whether it was actually LSD or some other compound doesn't make that much difference. Pont Saint-Esprit is actually not just this happened once in the world in a village in France. It's consistent with all the other experiments on the public that have done in the United States and done for a documented fact.
To achieve their goals, would the Americans be prepared to use a whole village as a laboratory? After all, these are civilians, not trained soldiers. However, in September 1950, nearly 1 year before Pont Saint-Esprit, this is exactly what they did, and in their own country. Off the coast of San Francisco, the American Marines were carrying out military maneuvers. A ship approached the coast and bombarded the city with a bacteria causing nucosomia, Serratia marcescens. The military were testing the effects of spraying this through the air. This classified secret defense map shows the scale of the targeted area. At least 11 people were hospitalized, one of whom died of pneumonia. The villagers wonder why a supposedly festive drug that is loved by hippies would have had such terrifying effects at Pont Saint-Esprit. James Ketchum, the military psychiatrist who specialized in LSD, a little reluctantly, admits that the drug is scary for those who take it unknowingly.
Some individuals could have a bad trip if someone gave them LSD and didn't tell them about it. That's very anxiety producing. Or if they were inexperienced and not particularly well balanced themselves, took a fairly large dose of LSD, they could have a bad trip. How would you feel if you had a cup of coffee and started to see things going like this or like this, brilliant colors appear on the ceiling, or suddenly you felt you're out of your body and looking down on yourself? These are all things that can happen with LSD.
But can these effects have a delayed onset? In Pont Saint-Esprit, the older generation remember the night of the apocalypse, where dozens of men went mad and were sectioned in a psychiatric unit because of terrifying visions. This night took place more than 2 weeks after the cursed bread was consumed. But again, James Ketchum admits that it's possible.
Some individuals had flashbacks later in which they would go into a situation where they had been when they were taking LSD and have a flood of the same emotions and some of them anxiety producing.
In 1951, French investigators also consider LSD and call upon Albert Hoffman, inventor of the drug. On the spot, he tells the investigators that he has no doubt that the hallucinations were due to LSD. But after returning to Switzerland, he backtracks, claiming he was mistaken. The French want explanations, but public health documents from 1951 show that the expert became suddenly unreachable. We are sorry that the eminent professor has not been able to get back in touch with us.
I would think if the Sandoz scientists are saying it doesn't seem to be LSD, they're just trying to cover up the fact that it's 100% for sure that LSD must have come from Sandoz, because they were the only suppliers. It's nothing more than a cover-up.
After months of inquiry, the French investigators were so disoriented by the number of fruitless leads that the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit falls victim to its own mystery. During this time, the experiments continued in the United States, and they reached a level never seen before in any country, including the Soviet bloc.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
UN Special Rapporteur has emphasized the extensive humanitarian need across Syria, where millions still depend on international assistance, and that the CSAR Act raises concerns under international law. What particularly alarms me is the way the US CSAR Act runs roughshod over human rights, including the Syrian people's rights to housing, health, and an adequate standard of living and development. Alina Duhan said. She added, the US government must not put obstacles in the way of rebuilding of hospitals because lack of medical care threatens the entire population's very right to life. Impeding access to supplies needed to repair infrastructure damaged by the conflict, Duhan said, will have a negative impact on human rights of the Syrian people and may preserve the trauma of the decade-long conflict. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, UN Human Rights Expert Urges U.S. to Lift Sanctions That May Exacerbate the Already Dire Humanitarian Situation in Syria. Here's the details of this article. A United Nations human rights expert on Tuesday, December 29th, called for the removal of unilateral U.S. sanctions targeting Syria, warning that despite the baseless claims by Donald Trump administration and congressional leaders that the measures aren't intended to harm the people of war-torn Syria, they may do just that. The sanctions violate the human rights of the Syrian people, whose country has been destroyed by almost 10 years of ongoing conflict, said Alina Duhan, UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. The conflict and violence have already had a dire impact on the ability of the Syrian people to realize their fundamental rights, having extensively damaged houses, medical units, schools, and other facilities. Duhan's statement follows a new round of sanctions that the outgoing U.S. administration announced last week, just over a year after President Donald Trump signed into law annual defense spending legislation that included the bipartisan CSAR Syria Civilian Protection Act. When the law took effect in June 2020, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said, the Treasury Department and the State Department are releasing 39 designations under the CSAR Act and Executive Order 13894 as the beginning of what will be a sustained campaign of economic and political pressure. Last week, while announcing the latest sanctions, The U.S. Secretary acknowledged the recent one-year anniversary of the President signing the CSAR Act and said that the United States will also continue to pressure Syria. Duhan, meanwhile, expressed alarm about the potential consequences of wide-ranging U.S. sanctions, which could target any foreigner helping Syria, even with rebuilding infrastructure, especially given the country's ongoing forcible displacement crisis and bread lines so long that children have to skip school to wait in them, which is perhaps the most visible and painful manifestation of Syria's economic meltdown, as the Washington Post reported recently. In a recent tweet noting the bread crisis, Media Benjamin, co-founder of the peace group Code Pink, condemned U.S. sanctions on Syria as collective punishment. Duhan said on Tuesday, December 29th, that "I am concerned that sanctions imposed under the CSAR Act may exacerbate the already dire humanitarian situation in Syria, especially in the course of the COVID-19 pandemic, and put the Syrian people at even greater risk of human rights violations." When it announced the first sanctions under the CSAR Act in June 2020, the United States said it did not intend for them to harm the Syrian population, she continued. Yet, enforcement of the act may worsen the existing humanitarian crisis, depriving the Syrian people of the chance to rebuild their basic infrastructure. Concerns remain about their rebuilding efforts. Duhan also emphasized the extensive humanitarian need across the nation, where millions still depend on international assistance, and that the CSAR Act raises concerns under international law. "What particularly alarms me is the way the U.S. CSAR Act runs roughshod over human rights, including the Syrian people's rights to housing, health, and an adequate standard of living and development," she said. "The U.S. government must not put obstacles in the way of rebuilding of hospitals because lack of medical care threatens the entire population's very right to life. Impeding access to supplies needed to repair infrastructure damaged by the conflict," Duhan said, "will have a negative impact on human rights of the Syrian people and may preserve the trauma of the decade-long conflict."
Around the World with Reporters.
Iran has marked the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Iraq's PMU commander Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes. The ceremony was attended by a small group of people from all walks of life and senior officials due to anti-COVID health protocols. Addressing the ceremony, Iran's judiciary chief Ayatollah Raisi has warned the enemies should await Iran's harsh revenge for the killing of Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani. Ayatollah Raisi also said the assassination of anti-terror commander Soleimani will fail to undermine the resistance front.
"By assassinating the hero of the fight against terrorism in the region and the world, the creators of Daesh and Al-Qaeda imagine that the resistance front would become weak. But they are wrong. The resistance front will never lose its strength. The assassination of General Soleimani has injected fresh energy into the spirit of resistance among people of the region."
Moreover, head of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, Brigadier General Ismail Aani, said Soleimani was the hero of defeating arrogance.
General Soleimani was the man of resistance and logic. His path will continue. Those who assassinated him should be prepared for harsh revenge. General Soleimani was the hero of defeating arrogance. He is the hero of the Iranian nation and a hero of the Islamic Ummah.
A number of foreign dignitaries, including senior officials from Islamic Jihad, Iraq's Hashd al-Shaabi, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, as well as Yemeni ambassador, were among the participants at this event, who talked about different aspects of the personality of General Qasem Soleimani. One of the foreign dignitaries who attended the ceremony was Hashem Safieddin, senior official of Lebanon's Hezbollah, who said the resistance movement should continue the path of Soleimani. He also noted General Soleimani and assassinated Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis protected the world against the Daesh terror group.
Haji Qasem Soleimani was a peaceful man because he became a general. He has been fighting for everyone. He has been fighting for humanity. Such people, we need them. Such people, there are few in this world.
General Qasem Soleimani was a man of resistance. His behavior and his beliefs taught the lesson of life. To all freedom seekers, he is a role model. He was a symbol of the fight against oppression. His name will remain in history forever.
General Soleimani, former commander of the IRGC Boats Force, was killed in a U.S. drone attack in Iraq on January 3, 2020.
On the first martyrdom anniversary of General Qasem Soleimani, senior Iranian officials have once again vowed to bring to justice the main perpetrators of his assassination in due time. According to Iranian officials, a lawsuit which has been filed in Iran against the U.S. for assassinating General Qasem Soleimani is in its final stage, and soon a court session will be held in this regard. Salman Kujiri, Tehran.
After dozens of civilians, including Ghadi's government officials, were killed and injured in the attack on Aden Airport, the deputy head of the Emirati-backed Southern Transitional Council, Hani bin Barak, accused Qatar and Turkey of being behind it, ruling out that Sana'a was involved in it.
It's clear who's behind this latest attack in Aden Airport is the one who benefit the most from this attack, and is United Arab Emirates. United Arab Emirates and its forces in Aden, because United Arab Emirates doesn't want to be there a government which can actually express the term Yemen, or which can actually be in Aden. That's why United Arab Emirates, they want south of Yemen to be divided, all Yemen to be divided, so the United Arab Emirates can control Bab al-Mandab and the Bab al-Mandab Strait, and as well control Socotra Island. And
videos that went viral on social media showed that the missiles were launched from inside the Green City in Aden, which made observers accuse the SCC of seeking to push back Hadi's government to Riyadh hotels and fail the Riyadh agreement.
The Riyadh agreement implemented its objectives regarding the main interests of the Saudi and Emirati occupation authorities. Therefore, the Riyadh agreement formed this government to require it to implement the surrender of Yemeni sovereignty and not to administer any land controlled by the occupation forces.
The deputy head of SDC had preempted the arrival of the new Hadi government with a campaign to raise the flags of South Yemen in private and public facilities, including Aden International Airport, and he also warned members of the Hadi government not to talk about Yemeni unity, which confirmed the continuing tension between the two parties to the conflict in southern Yemen.
There is no place for Hadi and his government in Aden. This is the message that the attack on the airport carried, meaning that Aden will continue to suffer under the rule of the militias of the UAE-backed STC. Abdul Latif al-Washalib, Sana'a.
We're back in the eye of the storm. These were the words of Simon Stevens, the head of Britain's National Health Service, as more people are in hospital with COVID-19 now than at the peak